Well, good morning once again, everybody. Dave Nemo with you here as we continue on down the line. Been looking forward to talking to our next guest for some time now. Robert Clara is with us. Robert's book, FDR's Funeral Train, is a fascinating book. It's really a pleasure to read this book as well. The subtitle, A Betrayed Widow, A Soviet Spy, A Presidency in the Balance. All of that and a lot more are covered in the book, and we're going to cover some of those here this morning with Robert. And Robert, thanks for being on the show. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Dave. Thank you for having me.
You know, when I'm reading the book, you kind of trick the reader, I think, in a sense. And here's what I mean by that. Mm-hmm. The book is written in such a easy, leisurely fashion that it's hard to kind of get your head around the fact that all of this stuff was happening, boom, 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 in less than 36 hours, or rather than less than 3 days. And, you know, what I wanted to see if you had a sense is that from the time that, and we're going to kind of go back before FDR's death on April 13th, but from the time he died on April 13th to the time the train arrived at his home in New York in Hyde Park.
Up in Hyde Park, right.
Everything was all happening at once.
Yeah.
But the way you lay out the book, it kind of gives you a sense of an elongated period. Did the people back then, do you think, feel like they were, was time suspended for them? Or was time
actually,
just...
I did get that sense.
Yeah.
I was very lucky in that I was able to locate quite a bit of personal writing that had been left behind by the people who were aboard this train and involved in planning it. Some of the writing was had been published in long-forgotten books, but a good deal of it, they were private diaries. And the advantage to using that as a research source is that people were writing just for themselves, and so they were very candid in their style. And as I read these, I got the sense that while there was certainly a sense of incredible gravitas to the time and an amazing weight that they felt in the planning to do the right thing, it almost seemed as though it were like a dreamscape that they were stumbling through. There was a sense that everything kind of slowed down for them. And I think that makes sense because people who go through profound grief in a way it can experience that. They're almost able to split their minds in two and take care of what needs to be done, and at the same time, they're kind of floating through it in a peripheral sense. And I wanted to imbue the text with a bit of that dreamlike quality, and I hope I did some of that.
You did, and thank you for answering that question, because I was kind of torn on that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't make up my mind what was really going on there sometimes because of the way you've laid it out, but again, it was from so many personal recollections, and some of the things you have in there are just remarkable.
Part of the reason why I wanted to do that as well is I took exactly one history course in my entire life, and it's not that I didn't enjoy it, but I was always irked by history being so flat and mechanical and little more than just a regurgitation of dates and places and people. And you know, when you think of how we experience monumental events in our lives, of course, it's nothing like that. It's intensely personal and difficult and emotional and so many intensely personal things like that. And so, I wanted to write the book in a style that kind of put you the reader in the middle of that, almost as though you were there. And I mean that not only in the sense of feeling physically aboard the train, but almost as though you were feeling like you were one of the people who were involved in the planning. And I thought it was important to do that, especially because it's a very difficult topic. A lot of people crinkled their noses when I told them that I was writing about this, because there's a certain amount of revulsion that people have toward death, especially in this country. And understandably so, it's a very difficult topic. But I wanted to bring it forward as a human experience, especially as it related to, you know, perhaps the most famous president that we've had.
Exactly. And one of the most beloved, if and our longest sitting president, too, for that matter.
Yes, he served for so long that they Congress took care of that in short order when Truman took office by instituting term limits.
But folks grew up with FDR.
Yeah, I mean, I made the point somewhere in the book that at the time of his death, and I don't remember the figure offhand, but if you were 12 years old or younger, you had never known another president.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's just simply something that that is not possible now, for better or worse, probably for better. You know, it. I think that people had also asked me, you know, why the death of any great leader is an event of tremendous pathos and gravitas. So why FDR? And I think it was a combination of not only the fact that he was president for so long and so many people only knew him. I mean, Roosevelt became synonymous with president for so many years, but he was also the man who uniquely led the country first through the Great Depression, and then, as though that weren't enough for the poor man, he had to lead the country through the Second World War as well. And I think today we don't have as much of a sense of what it's like to look up to a leader and depend on a leader in such a personal way. I mean, there were pictures, framed pictures of FDR in kitchens across the United States, and not only in the kitchens of Democrats either. There was a sense that this man had saved a lot of people's lives. And so when he was gone, the sense of personal loss was, it's very difficult for us to imagine now. And that's something else that I wanted to bring forward, is how disorientating that must have felt to everybody.
In fact, speaking of pictures of FDR, you basically had a picture of FDR as a bit of inspiration yourself when you were writing the book.
Yeah, it's funny. I never planned it that way, but because these days, given the state of the publishing industry, a lot of people think that when authors sit down, there's a whole team of 25 people helping us to put these books together, and in reality, we kind of fly solo. And so I was responsible for getting all the photographs that are in that book, and so I started my search very early. And one of the things that I came across was this was a little picture of FDR that was mounted on a piece of wood and then shellacked. And these were sold in the early 30s, when the Depression really had first, you know, sunk its teeth into the neck of the country. People bought these because they had pinned such tremendous hopes on Roosevelt, and they hung these things up in their houses. And I bought one, and I hammered it into my wall, and I looked into this guy's eyeballs for 16 months while I wrote. And it's kind of funny because I not to be all new agey about this, but I kind of after a while felt like I was developing a bit of a relationship with him myself.
Now you write a lot about the railroad. Your work has appeared in the New York Times, New York Daily News, American Heritage, you name it, Christian Science Monitor, Town and Country Architecture. But this is your first book.
Yes, it is my first book, yes.
How did that happen?
Well, it's kind of funny. I would like to say it's because, you know, my creativity finally, you know, rose to the level of sublimity required to write a book. But in fact, it was largely an outgrowth of how difficult it became to find magazine work in the past few years.
Oh.
I was writing a lot of history pieces for a lot of titles, as you had mentioned. And suddenly, I found that it was harder and harder to get assignments for the types of stories that I wanted to do. The word counts were decreasing, and the pay was decreasing. And I sat around thinking, well, you know, I could keep plowing all these efforts into, you know, writing 500-word blurbs, or I could finally decide to, you know, really let her rip and do a book and not worry about an editor cutting me off just when I'm ready to get started.
Yeah.
I finally did it. It wrote itself. I don't want to say wrote itself. I wrote it, but it happened quite quickly. I'm always amazed when I read stories about you know, giants of the book profession, people like Robert Caro or David McCulloch, taking, you know, 10 and 12 years to write a book. You know, I researched this for a good many months, but it basically took me about 16 months, which for a book is pretty quick.
Pretty quick. And folks can get your book pretty quick, too. It's available at Amazon.com and other sites around the country, bookstores. It's out from Palgrave Macmillan.
Yes, that's correct.
The book is called FDR's Funeral Train, A Betrayed Widow, A Soviet Spy, and A Presidency in the Balance. Robert, is it safe to say that this train, and I don't want folks to misunderstand, FDR didn't die and then was put on a train and then brought to Washington and Hyde Park. This was his train through his presidency. This is tantamount to Air Force One on rails, correct?
Absolutely, yes. In fact, prior to the institution of Air Force One, which was a name that actually JFK came up with for the plane, Harry Truman was the first one to start to divide his travels between railroads and airplanes. And the first presidential plane, by the way, was called the Sacred Cow. That's what Truman called it. But prior to Truman, trains were how presidents traveled. And this was an entirely self-contained rolling White House. It was usually between 9 and 12 cars long. These were all what were called heavyweight Pullman cars, and they weighed about 80 tons apiece. They were like rolling hotel rooms. I mean, they had staterooms and bars aboard and dining cars. And of course, toward the tail end of the train, there was a personal car that had been created specifically for FDR. And so the funeral train, as you point out, was not just something that was cobbled together quickly. As one person actually suggested, much to my horror, it was not a freight train either. It was actually the president's regular train that he traveled around in. It went by an acronym, a rather indelicate acronym called POTUS, which stood for President of the United States. And when the president wanted to go somewhere, his transportation office would call all the railroads in advance. And when the dispatchers heard that POTUS was on its way, they basically suspended every other train within miles. It had to stop totally cold and allow the presidential train to pass. And so this was the train that the casket was put aboard.
You know, you bring up something that I was going to actually ask you, Robert. Mm-hmm. The term POTUS, in fact, here on Sirius XM, we have a channel called POTUS.
I didn't know that.
It was launched during the recent presidential campaign, mm-hmm. and now the P has been changed from president to politics, so it's politics of the United States, but the channel is very popular on satellite radio. That term, I thought, was a little more modern than it is. Did the term POTUS originate with this train, do you think, or did it?
I'm pretty sure that it did, yes.
That surprised
me. And the reason for that was prior to Pearl Harbor, the security measures that were taken to protect the train were simply not needed. And this might be a good place to interject that FDR's private Pullman car, which was called the Ferdinand Magellan, had been built as an ordinary, and I say ordinary in a relative sense, it was a very luxurious car with silk upholstered seats and gold leaf on the ceilings. It was an ordinary car that had been built by Pullman out in Chicago, basically for moguls to chuff around in. After Pearl Harbor, they took this car and brought it back to the Pullman shops, stripped it apart, and they armor plated it. And so you had 5/8-inch thick steel covering all sides of this, and the windows were 3 inches thick. The entire car, when they were done with it, weighed a little over 142 tons. It took two locomotives just to pull this thing. And to this day, it is the heaviest railroad car ever to roll on the American railroads.
The normal Pullman, the heavy-duty Pullmans were normally 80 tons. This was 142.
That's correct, yeah.
That made it, that's a lot of weight, a lot of extra weight, but that actually made some difference in terms of the locomotives that had to pull this thing.
Yeah, it usually required them to add a second locomotive, mainly when the train ran south of Washington, and that was simply because there were more hills that they had to deal with. Mm-hmm. When they went north, the tracks tended to be flatter, and they could get away with a single engine a great deal of the time. I should also point out that the incredibly durable construction of the Ferdinand Magellan also gave them an incredible problem when they were preparing to put FDR's coffin on board, because the plan, of course, had been to put his coffin into his private railroad car. It was not until the last minute that the funeral director, who was a gentleman by the name of Fred Patterson out of Atlanta, discovered that FDR's coffin would not fit aboard the car, because the only way in was a 1,500-pound door in the back, and the coffin wouldn't fit through there. And because the windows were 3-inch thick plate glass, they couldn't be removed. And so what they had to do was take the Secret Service's Pullman and put FDR's coffin into that car. And it was one of several glitches. Fortunately, not too many, and the public was, of course, none the wiser. Mm-hmm. But that was a small glitch in the plans. Fortunately, the Secret Service car was a lounge car, and it had very, very large observation windows in the back, and those windows were of the size that they could be removed, and they were big enough, the frames were big enough that a coffin could be fit through.
Well, this coffin itself was a monster, too.
It was
right?
a monster, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was solid copper with a bronze finish, which was something of a rarity during the war years because, as I'm sure you know, metal of almost every type was required to build munitions. And so, of course, though, when you're the president, certain strings can be pulled. And it was quite fortunate for the men down in Warm Springs, Georgia, when they called the Fred Patterson funeral chapter. Patterson just so happened to have one of the few remaining metal coffins around that he had put into storage. And it also, again, by incredible luck, happened to be long enough for FDR's body, because he was an extraordinarily tall man, which surprises a lot of people, because obviously in most photographs you see of him, he's seated.
One of the things, too, about the train trips that he took, and he took quite a number of them during his presidency.
Yeah, he traveled more rail miles than any president in history. He loved to travel by train.
He didn't allow the trains to go over 30 miles an hour.
No, he didn't, and that created a lot of... Well, it meant that his tours were very long and leisurely, for one thing. But the reason for that is actually, it's quite moving. Because of the polio that FDR had, which at the time was called infantile paralysis, it not only made it impossible for him to walk, but it also severely atrophied the muscles on the lower portion of his body. And it's difficult to put this delicately, but basically the muscles in the posterior region were so emaciated that when FDR sat down, it was basically like his tailbone was riding directly on the wood of the seat. Mm. And so when the train went quickly, every bump was something that FDR felt right up his spine, and it was very painful for him. So he ordered the train not to exceed 30 miles an hour, and the slower pace made it easier for him to make the trip.
He goes to Warm Springs to get away from the heat and humidity of Washington, D.C. Warm Springs is an important place. That was called if the train was the rolling White House, then Warm Springs was the little White House.
It was the little White House,
explained.
And incredibly little. It was a tiny cabin at the top of Pine Mountain, and for those who've been there, they kind of do a double take when they're told that this was called the Little White House. It was exceedingly modest. As I point out in the book, the dimensions of his cabin were actually smaller than the Pullman car that brought him there. It was just basically... It was a rustic cabin with knotty pine walls and, some rag rugs on the floor and a few rocking chairs. FDR liked it that way. When he got away, he wanted to achieve some distance from the formality of Washington, and he adored Warm Springs, not only for its seclusion, but also, of course, in the early 20s, when he made his first trip there, he had heard about the purportedly healing powers of the thermal waters that bubbled out of the ground at Warm Springs, and he spent many years going down there to take swims in the thermal pools in the belief that eventually it would restore enough power to his legs to allow allow him to walk. Unfortunately, that never happened, but his faith was such that he kept going, and also, to give a measure of how magnanimous this man was, he basically parted with a good deal of his personal fortune to buy Warm Springs and open it up as the very first polio treatment facility in the United States. And it is still open and functions at that, for that purpose.
I don't know a lot of people realize that.
Yeah, it's one of the legacies that most of the time when you hear about FDR's legacy, it's accompanied by a good deal of fist-pounding and talk of entitlement programs. But regardless of how you feel about that politically, I think it's very, very difficult to criticize a man who was truly born to the purple and not only decided to go into a life of public service, but also decided to basically take the majority of his money and give it to a group of disabled people who, up until that time, were essentially thrown into institutions and forgotten about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You know what? I'm looking at the clock. We haven't even scratched the surface. We haven't even talked about some of the characters that were on the train. We haven't talked about Harry Truman and the transition of power that actually...
This is my fault, Dave. I'm running my mouth.
Well, you know what? if you can hang through a break, I'd love to have you hold over with us.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a break here for news and weather, and then we'll come back and talk some more, and because some of the people on the train were very interesting, but the whole thing about Truman and Truman's relationship with Roosevelt before Roosevelt's death is very surprising, and the way Truman stepped up is also very gratifying in terms of how he pretty much just came out of nowhere and took hold of the country and the war all at the same time.
Absolutely.
Essentially on this train.
Absolutely.
If anybody wants to know why there's a book entitled FDR's Funeral Train, it may be a sliver of history, but it is a pivotal sliver of history. And we'll find out more about why it's so important when we come back. Robert Clara is with us. He's the author of FDR's Funeral Train, A Betrayed Widow, A Soviet Spy, and A Presidency in the Balance. The book is published by Palgrave Macmillan, and you can get it on Amazon.com and of course, bookstores and a lot of the different websites. It's really a great book to read. It's a very good history. We'll be right back. Robert Clara is with us. The book is FDR's Funeral Train, A Betrayed Widow, A Soviet Spy, A Presidency in the Balance, available at Amazon.com and other places, of course, online and in stores from Palgrave Macmillan. And Robert, thanks for staying with us because we just got started.
Listen, no problem. It's my pleasure.
You know, I want to talk about each one of these three factors on the cover. Mm-hmm. But before we do that, we almost started to mention this a little bit earlier. This was a loved man by the country. And when this funeral train, it didn't have any decoration on it whatsoever. It wasn't, decked out in any way. People knew what this train was about. They knew it was coming. Everybody that was in anywhere near the tracks from Warm Springs up to Washington and then up to Hyde Park turned out. Some of the largest crowds this country's ever seen, and you could hear a pin drop in every one of those towns.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's important to point out that at the time that FDR died, of course, you had radio, but there was no television yet, and people were not yet used to the idea of mourning a public figure while standing in their living rooms in front of the TV set, and so the incredible sense of national grief was such that people felt that they needed to pay their respects personally, and going to Washington, D.C., of course, was too difficult for many of them. But you had well over 1,000 miles of train track that this train would be traveling on, and so people had the idea to make their way to the track and wait alongside. And what I found amazing about that was that this was a time of national gasoline rationing, and driving someplace required a good deal of ingenuity. In some cases, people had to take their ration tickets and combine them to fill the tank and pile the car with family and friends and other relatives. And they would drive. Sometimes people would drive a day and a half. And then they would stand by the railroad tracks and wait for the opportunity just to salute this train. And some people stood all night long. Margaret Truman remembers in her diary opening up her Pullman berth window, her window shade at night, and looking out and seeing people, ghostly faces lit by the light of bonfires by the sides of the tracks.
Yeah, yeah. And the train, you know, we mentioned that for the physical reasons required by the president, when he was alive, the train would only go 30 miles per hour.
Right.
The funeral train, which was the same train essentially, there were two trains later on, but essentially the funeral train, was only going 25 miles an hour in deference to the people who were coming out. So
yes, that was Eleanor Roosevelt's idea. She understood that the turnout, although even she was surprised later by how many people had turned out, it was estimated that at least in part of the route, there were more people who had turned out to see his train than had come for all four of his inaugurals. And so she realized that with the tens of thousands of people, and obviously there was no attempt made to count them all, but with the tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of people who stood by the tracks, that you simply couldn't have a train blowing past at 85, 90 miles an hour. Not only would it be dangerous, you could possibly hit somebody, but you know, people would be standing so near the tracks that the train, if the train passed quickly, they would just be met with a face full of track dust. And Eleanor Roosevelt understood that that was not the proper way to repay people's respects. And so even though they knew that it would make for an awfully long trip, as you know, as the book details, about three entire days, it was decided to keep the train at a slow pace for that reason.
You have a great photograph, and you tell a great this section of the story going through South Carolina, Greenville, 25,000 people. And you mentioned the photograph, that there was an aerial photograph in the book, and I didn't realize there was that you had it in the book until I got there, and
yes,
that's a great photo.
Yeah, and people had stood just to get a look. A lot of people had stood on the tops of the rails of the surrounding tracks, and when that photograph was taken from the air by an Army reconnaissance plane, it gave the unusual illusion of train tracks that were made out of people.
Yeah.
And I actually, later in a lecture that I gave at the FDR Presidential Library, I was lucky enough to meet a gentleman who was actually one of the guards at that station. And it was an incredibly moving experience. All these years later, he remembered it as though it had happened yesterday.
Having read the book, I know what the first tagline means, a betrayed widow.
Mm-hmm.
It speaks a lot about our society in that day. It also speaks a great deal about the way the press deferred to the president in those days as well.
Absolutely.
Lucy
Rutherford. FDR had two very big secrets that the press cooperated in keeping from public view, and one of them, of course, the main one, was his paralysis. The second one was that FDR had a dalliance relatively early in his marriage, around the First World War, when he was Assistant Navy Secretary, with a young, well-born woman in Washington who he had hired as his social secretary. I'm sorry, Eleanor's social secretary, and her name was Lucy Rutherford. And it's a very long story. Many people have written about it, and I was cautious in the book because I did not want to overblow it. It was obvious that the two of them had an affair back around 1918 that went on for a couple of years. When Eleanor found out, as a condition of keeping the marriage intact, she made FDR promise never to see Lucy again. And it's important to point out that divorce at that time would have ended FDR's political career because of the social stigma. And so FDR made that agreement. But of course, as time went on, he kind of softened a bit, and Lucy had crept back into his life. And whether she did so romantically or not is something that we'll probably never know. But the fact of the matter is that FDR had promised Eleanor that he would never see Lucy again. And in fact, he was seeing her. And she had made some furtive trips to the White House over the years. And it turned out that she was also down in Warm Springs at the time that he died. She was in the room when he suffered the hemorrhage. And Eleanor found out about Lucy's presence. Again, it's a little foggy. She might have found out just before she arrived down there from Washington. Some accounts said that she found out on the train. But in any case, as she boarded the funeral train for the trip back to Washington, she had just come to realize that the woman who had ended her marriage was in the same room with her husband when he died. And the incredible weight of that realization is difficult to imagine. And that was the frame of mind in which Eleanor Roosevelt rode the funeral train of her husband.
And never let it show. The way you describe her countenance during that trip is amazing.
It is astonishing. And she had been asked about that discreetly later on, and her response, which I, you know, ascribe some credibility to, was that, you know, she had been raised in the proper Victorian mores of the time, which held that you do not share personal news with people, that you do not let your emotions leak out, and that you need to retain a sense of decorum in public. And as Eleanor herself said, the amenities had to be observed. So however she dealt with that in her private moments is anybody's guess. But in public, she was strong as a piece of granite, and it gave me yet another reason to admire her.
One of the things you also did not do was have an open casket funeral. FDR's casket was closed essentially for the duration, which, and boy, if you think you got conspiracy theories floating around today, they went wild at the time.
Yes, yeah. Unfortunately, keeping the casket lid closed was a completely understandable decision. But, you know, as you and I know very well, every time a famous person dies, it's usually about 4 minutes before crazy theories start to arise. And it doesn't matter if it's a president or Michael Jackson, there's always something kooky that people are trying to say about what really happened. And of course, with FDR, it was no exception. There were rumors that he had not died, that he had gone insane, and that he was being kept somewhere against his will. He was posing as somebody else. And unfortunately for these fortunately for these conspiracy theorists, the lack of an autopsy and a closed casket was just what they needed to advance this idea that the government was hiding something. The truth is, the lid was kept closed for two reasons. One, because Eleanor and Franklin had both agreed prior to his death that lying in state, they believed personally, was a distasteful practice, and they did not want it to happen. And the other factor, which I had to treat very delicately, was that the severity of the hemorrhage that FDR suffered was such that it actually disfigured his face. Mm-hmm. And the cyanosis basically colored his face purple and distorted his smile, and he basically bore very little resemblance to the FDR that people knew. And for a man who would be burned indelibly into people's memory for that incredible smile of his, it's hard to imagine how that would have been marred by a vision of him lying in that coffin. And so the decision was made to keep it closed, and I personally felt that that was the appropriate thing to do.
When our listeners pick up the book, they will enjoy reading about Mr. X and some of the other people.
Mr. X. Yeah. I wish I could have met Mr. X, but if only for a few minutes.
We'll take a break. We're going to take a break right here, Robert, and sure. We'll come right back.
Of course.
Robert Clara is with us, and it's a fascinating book called FDR's Funeral Train from Palgrave Macmillan, available all over. Amazon.com has it, but all of the usual sources will have this book, and it's really a great read. Robert Clara is with us. FDR's Funeral Train is the book. The presidency was in the balance, and I was surprised to read, and I don't know a lot about Harry Truman, and I guess I should know more, but I guess he was the ultimate, can't say that word right now, the ultimate Washington outsider. He came out of nowhere. Nobody knew who he was.
Yeah.
And he was pretty much kept on the outside during his short vice presidency. Mm-hmm. He and Roosevelt, I think you said, only really met like 8 times, and most of that was just nothing.
Yeah, it's hard to believe now, especially given the rise of the power of the vice presidency. But at the time, FDR had to choose a fourth running mate for his fourth term, and Truman emerged as a consensus candidate. There were men who arguably were better qualified, but there was some kind of political problem with every single one of them. Truman was very, very popular in the Senate because he had run the Truman Committee, and FDR decided that if he put Truman on the bill, the plan was when it finally came time to negotiate the peace for the end of the Second World War, Truman would help him get that through Congress. And that was basically the main reason for naming Truman to the ticket. And because FDR basically saw Truman as a good guy to have in his vest pocket, he made no particular effort to school him in the statesmanship that may very well be required of him. And given the precarious state of FDR's health, that was a tragic decision. And so when FDR died and Truman suddenly found himself sworn into office, he basically had absolutely no idea how to conduct the presidency. And all of the top secret information about the conduct of the war, the Manhattan Project with the atomic bomb, the strange and erratic behavior of Joseph Stalin, Truman knew none of those things at the time. And so what happened was that the funeral train, which represented 18 hours of time shortly after Truman took office, was something that Truman very shrewdly realized was a period that he needed to take advantage of. And so he packed his private Pullman car, and he had another private Pullman car called the Roald Amundsen, and he filled that with some of the luminaries that had worked for FDR, and spent a good deal of that time in what I guess you could call an intense tutorial, where he was brought up to speed on essentially how to become president. He was getting ready to deliver a State of the Union address that following Monday, and he needed to look every inch the president. The country was in a panic because it had lost a strong leader of 12 years. Most people didn't even know who Harry Truman was, and when he ascended to that podium, he had to project authority and confidence, which were things that he didn't have in long supply at the time he was sworn in. So we have the funeral train to thank for giving Harry Truman the time and opportunity to basically take a crash course in how to become president.
Yeah, that is an amazing story. And Truman actually did it and pulled it off better than I think even he thought it could have been.
It surprised me. I having crashed for enough exams myself, I don't think I could have learned that much in 18 hours.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of being the ultimate outsider, you mentioned Margaret Truman a little bit earlier, his daughter. A lot of people didn't even know she existed.
Yeah.
They almost left her off the list to get on the train.
Yeah, they left her off the guest list of the train.
They didn't know her name or anything.
They didn't put her in there.
Yeah.
Somebody said, oh, by the way, the Trumans have a daughter.
Yeah, didn't even know her name.
One of the common phrases that floated around the White House shortly after FDR died was, who the hell is Harry Truman?
Yeah. Well, one of the tagline on the book is a presidency in the balance, but the war all of a sudden became in the balance too, or the way we ended it, because, as you point out, there was a lot of pressure on FDR himself to back off on the unconditional surrender demands that he was making of Japan and Germany.
Yes.
So as soon as he died, Harry Truman was pounced on, basically, hey, you're not really going to go with this, right? You're going to back off, right? And they gave him all these reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And that speech, and then the speech you're talking about, State of the Union, as you also bring out, they didn't even want him to make that speech.
No, they felt that it was too soon. They felt that FDR, at that point, would only have been buried for a day. The country was in mourning, and they felt that the country was not ready to hear from a new president. But here again, Truman smiled and nodded and thanked everyone for their advice and then proceeded to do what he thought was best, which later became a hallmark of his leadership. He understood shrewdly that the country might have been mourning and it might have been in panic, but more than anything else, it needed to be brought into a state of unity behind its new leader. He understood that the morale of the troops, the morale of the people working in the munitions plants back here in the States, everybody needed to come together and galvanize the way they had under FDR. And he understood that it was not for the sake of his popularity or his ego. It was for the sake of winning the Second World War that Harry Truman stepped forward as early and as stridently as he did to make sure that people understood who was in charge and what the plan was going to be.
You know, this is toward the, this is the last portion of the book when you talk about Truman and his speech, and we're kind of out of time here this morning, but I just wanted to say that as inspiring and interesting as the first part of this book is, I think it even became more so when it came to Truman himself, because he just hit a home run out of the park, out of the parking lot, out of the city.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And
it was one of the most successful State of the Union addresses ever delivered, and one of them that's pretty much all forgotten about now.
Yeah, and that's another fascinating aspect of the book. What are you working on now?
Well, apart from resting, I am actually working on a new book that will be about Harry Truman, because I learned so many incredible things about him in the course of researching this book that I think it's time to kind of dip back in and try to figure out what he was all about.
Well, we are looking forward to that and looking forward to having you back on to talk about it.
Dave, I would look forward to that, too. And you've been so gracious to have me on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Robert, and best to you.
Thank you.
Robert Clara, everybody. FDR's Funeral Train, a betrayed widow, a Soviet spy, a presidency in the balance. And again, it's at Amazon.com. I just looked that up, and here it is. But it'll be at Barnes & Noble and all of the book places if you want to get this. It's a great book. Very, very interesting. And we just kind of scratched the surface in our talk just now.